Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. I love it when listeners send me stuff, so feel free to do so. Bill at myfaithradio.com. Is that right, Rebecca? Is that right? Is that my address?
Yes, I believe it is.
Bill at myfaithradio.com.
Easy enough.
Yeah, yeah. A faithful listener, Jim, said, here are a couple of verses for you. Psalm 125, verse 1. Those who trust in the Lord are as Mount Zion, which cannot be moved, but abides forever. Rebecca, you said that that was something that was probably saying on the road, Jesus himself was probably singing that.
That's a fact that just makes me smile. That's one of the Psalm of Ascents, and those were the collection of psalms most often sung on the road when Jews would make their trek to Jerusalem, which I believe they did three times a year. Okay. I think they had those high holy days. I'm not sure, and it's early. But I think one of the things they would do to keep themselves occupied on the road is they would travel in groups, sometimes their families or sometimes these big, long, large groups of people, is they would sing praises to God on the road to Jerusalem. And you could hear their voices in the distance as they sang on the way to worship God. And Jesus would have done exactly that. And we hear actually about Jesus on the road to Jerusalem with his disciples.
Singing
and
away, probably.
This is one of the psalms that he most likely sang. And that just makes me smile.
Oh, it does me too. And they were walking together as groups because they did not have minivans with little TVs in them.
Also true.
Also true. So, and Matthew 6:34, so do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. And a favorite verse of Jim is 14:1. John 14:1 says, do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. So thank you. Thank you for that. All right. This is interesting. A Da Vinci painting. Apparently there's 15 to 20 in existence. Went on the auction block, hoping to fetch $100 million. It sold for $450 million. And they were really questioning whether or not it was real. Can you imagine forking out $450 million and going, yeah, I don't think it's real. But it was auctioned off in the modern and contemporary auction. And, of course, your first instinct might be, why in that category? And there is a theory that 90% of it was painted in the last 50 years. You know, you've got some touch-up work that's being done. But art historian said that if we look at his existing paintings, not a single one of them pictures a person straight on like this one. There's also not a single painting picturing an individual Jesus either. All of his paintings, even single portraits, depict figures in far more complex poses. Even the figure that comes closely to the painting would be St. John the Baptist. That's also from the 1500s. But it gives us a turning, young, Randy-looking man with hair utterly different from and much more developed in terms of painting than the few curls Christie's is raving about in their picture of Jesus. So, I don't know. Layout 450 mil, and you got to make sure you got the real thing. You got to make sure you got an original Da Vinci at that price. I don't know who you check in with, but that's a lot of money. All right. 7 minutes after the hour, Dr. Peter Kapsner is in studio. We'll be back talking to him in just a minute. I'm going to pay him a stipend for being here today. And everybody knows what a stipend is. As David St. Hubbins would say, a stipend is such a small amount of money, they don't call it money. They call it a stipend. Be back in just a minute. Is this your walk-up music, Peter?
It is for now. I mean, okay, I'm still a little mixed. I mean, we're kind of trying it out right now. We had Tchaikovsky last week, and now we've got a little U2 this week. And nothing's really sitting right. I mean, I like them both. They're solid, and they're verifiable. They're proven.
They are indeed.
They were the original.
They're recognizable, too.
They really
maybe
are.
Maybe not the Tchaikovsky, but U2, everybody kind of knows this.
Yeah, I went with that. I went to the concert when they were here locally.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did.
Was that at U.S. Bank?
It was. I couldn't understand any of the music because of the acoustics in there, but I understand U2 is pretty good.
Yeah. So, you have a ticket stub, proving you were there.
It was verified. So the same Da Vinci guy came over, and verified my ticket stub. So,
So $450 million for a painting, which may or may not be an actual original.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
It is crazy, and you know, it's part of why we were talking that I stopped bidding at about $15. I just wasn't certain about this thing. And how do you verify it? How do you know
for sure
at the end of the day?
Not to punch some holes in your theory here, but the bidding started at $100 million.
Oh, damn. Okay. That's why I never even got in the community to begin with. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So commercials that always end with a very, very fast-talking disclaimer. Do you ever listen to that?
Oh, they're my favorite.
If
you can slow those things down, it just cracks me up. And, I mean, it is literally 3 minutes worth of conversation crammed into, like, 6 seconds.
It is.
I love it.
And yet the whole world is sort of driven by lawyers and attorneys. So I guess it's something that actually we should be listening to, but we never do.
Yeah.
And it's almost become a joke, doesn't it? A punchline. It's like, oh, there's that fast-talking guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you go, what are you trying to cram down our throats right now that we're supposed to know that we're never going to even pay attention to?
Yeah, that's those disclaimers, as well as the disclaimers that come out amidst all the beautiful music when it's a pharmaceutical drug that talks about all the side effects. Those are my two favorite things to listen to.
And what about when you update your iTunes and you get this new agreement from Apple, which is about 19 pages? I know you read it. Before
every
you click,
time.
I agree.
I do. Well, you know, I get frustrated just having to scroll down to show that I might have read it. You know, you can't just click on it. It says you have to scroll down and then agree.
And that's annoying.
It is annoying. Yeah. You know, my time's too important for that.
Yeah. So all the stuff that's supposed to be important, we just seem to not pay attention to.
Yeah, that's actually really true.
Yeah,
it is,
I know it's supposed to be important, but we don't really care.
Right. No, we don't. I was actually listening to a TED Talk on the way into the show, and they were talking about having 1 minute TV episodes now that they're starting to write content for, because we just can't be bothered with taking time through information. So a 1 minute TV episode is some of what they're writing. I can't imagine the story that you can create in 1 minute, but that's where we're headed.
Well, it is interesting because when somebody sends you a link to a video, the first thing you do is check the time clock on it. And you go, a minute and 6 seconds, I might watch that now.
Absolutely.
But 7 minutes and 42 seconds, maybe later.
Yeah.
And 46 minutes, there's not a chance.
No, there's absolutely no chance. And we do, you know, if it's 30 seconds or less, then maybe somebody will take a look at it. But I can't even remember what my life was like 25 years ago when 7 minutes was something that would have been a very small slice. And now it's an eternity in our lives.
Right.
It feels like we can't be bothered with that.
Right. Which leads me into our meaningful discussion today, which is on some of the spiritual disciplines that maybe we don't practice very much, which would be silence and solitude. I don't think we like being alone with our thoughts. That's why they probably pipe music into elevators.
Yeah, I realized recently how much I've been struggling with just turning everything off. And I was with a pastoral friend of mine this week who was talking about a series of sermons that he was doing on the disciplines and invited me to come in and talk about silence and solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And it revealed in me just how little I like the silence. But There's a passage in John 10 where it talks where Jesus says, my sheep know my voice and I am the good shepherd. And I think about those times where I have spent time in silence, just listening to the voice of the good shepherd the best that I can. And there is a peacefulness that comes with that, that stands in stark contrast to all of the crazy online voices that we're listening to, all of the quick hitting 12 second Twitter feed things. And the voice of the shepherd sounds very different, but I don't attend to that nearly often enough in my life.
Mm-hmm. How often, you have five kids?
We have five kids, yep.
And so I'm curious as to silence and solitude, what are the available moments that you have for it?
Yeah.
How do you create those?
And my wife, Hallie, has been brilliant in starting right from the beginning with them in starting out their day with what we call circle time as a family. And we kind of stumbled into it. I mean, she knew what she was doing way more than me in this situation.
That I
believe. And we take time with the kids where literally that we just sit around the table and we're not even reading the Bible together and we do those things. Mm-hmm. But I think we just spend some time in silence and reflection and thinking about our day. And it really... If you start early, kids get into that rhythm, and it's not perfect, and we're not the perfect family by any stretch, but I've really seen the benefits of sitting around the table and just having that 30 minutes together in silence and solitude and some conversation prayer. So
let me see if I have this right. You sit around the table, and the family is in silence?
For an extended period of time, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and then we'll read a little bit, and then they might draw a little bit, but there is absolutely time where we can just sit.
That's fascinating.
The silence is wildly uncomfortable at first. I mean, it's not like anybody's going into this willingly, but I find that the stirring waters begin to calm pretty substantially after maybe a couple minutes into that time.
Okay, let's talk about the value of habits, and because this sounds like one of those habits that's going to sink into the bedrock of your child's psyche.
Yeah.
That's going to pay off in dividends throughout their whole life, even if it's uncomfortable right now.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope what it creates in them is a sense of contrast in their spirit, where they recognize the difference between being on their phone all day and the silence. And if we don't create a contrast in our kids' lives of different kinds of experiences through habits like you're describing, then it's very difficult to teach towards something or lead or shepherd them in a way to things that matter.
Do they see it as a discipline of that could be useful, or do they see it as punishment for being on their phones all the time?
I think, you know, it so much depends on how you start. And I think sometimes there's some kicking and screaming that happens, but most often for them, because Hallie started so early with them, is that it just got to be part of the rhythm as opposed to something that we had to institute later because they were on their phones too much. And so it started as more of an invitation, and I think it feels that way to the point that my 17-year-old has been sending me articles this week about the effects of being online, and he's seeing what's there. He's not just running with a crowd on some of that, and I'm really grateful for that piece of it right now.
Mm-hmm. Peter, let me go to break. I know that we were in trouble when I was in an elevator once, and I heard the song, "We Built This City on Rock and Roll," done by Muzak.
One of my favorites.
I know. It is 16 minutes after the hour. Dr. Peter Kapsner is with us. We'll be back in just a minute. So I was looking for my show prep, and of course the dog ate it, so a lot of material there, Peter.
Yeah, I don't know where to go from here.
No, I'm just kidding.
I
want to go back to silence and solitude, and as we are trying to prepare to be peaceful, because we all know the holidays can bring certain levels of chaos and stress, and they're anxiety-filled for a lot of people.
They are, and I think we wrestle through just trying to get to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing, and it's very difficult to sink into the experience of the holidays, and again, it's one of those disciplines. It's one of those spiritual disciplines to sort of sit back and say, you know, I may have struggled with my family from time to time, or some of these relationships get difficult from time to time. And yet, if you can find a bit of gratefulness for some pieces of the relationship, you can begin to enter into the holidays a lot of times in a different kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you have a great family situation and people that you enjoy spending time with, to just take a big pause. It becomes a very much of a Sabbath experience to sit with people and to be in community face to face, not in all these virtual reality, augmented reality kinds of situations. So,
yeah,
I was listening actually on the way into a woman. She was the script writer for Grey's Anatomy.
Well, you're listening to a TED Talk and listening to this.
Yeah.
I mean, how long is your commute? Like
well,
2 hours?
It's a very long time. Lots of silence and solitude, a little U2, and then some TED Talks. So, and with her, she was talking about she was very intrigued by the idea of this augmented and virtual reality that you could actually seem like you're sitting in a room with a pixelated image of this person, and you could have a conversation. And she uses the word intimate to describe the conversation with this pixelated image. And it really struck me and disturbed me on some level, because I thought that intimacy was for actual flesh and blood relationships where we're in the room with each other. And again, I think that can be the invitation of the holidays, is to remember that we actually are human beings and not augmented people.
Is there anything to do to prepare yourself to be part of a holiday with family that might cause internal stress? I mean, it seems that holidays have a tendency of putting the magnifying glass on your life. Everything looks a little bigger, a little bit more distorted, a little bit more a bit bigger than life stuff.
Yeah, it does. And I'm not great about doing this, but I do know if I can even just take again, on my long commute to my family experiences as well, because we just live so far away. If I can just take a few minutes and just shut everything down from conversation to radio and everything that I would otherwise be listening to. And again, try to hear the voice of the Good Shepherd in those moments. It's amazing the kind of peace and stability that you can enter into these stressful situations with then. And that's, you know, Jesus spent time in the wilderness listening to the voice of his Father and as the Spirit led him there. And he was able to minister in some crazy situations as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. And we always go back to that as a foundational discipline to be alone with the Father, to be intentional with God's word as you communicate with him. But the level of distraction today is, I don't know, this is disturbing to me, as it probably is to you too, because you deal with students all day long. And you were saying during the break that they have no experience as a human being not being connected digitally.
Yeah, that the idea that the generation after the millennial generation is beginning to be referred to as the iGen generation, where there has never been time in their life that they've spent outside of understanding their gadgets. And I was reading some interesting articles from a psychologist from the University of San Diego who had been doing quite a bit of research on this and talking about just the sheer unhappiness factor that's coming in to these young people's lives. And they're spending most of their time feeling safe in their rooms and virtual communities as opposed to out in the world among actual people. And on one level, it's safer, but on the other level, it's created some havoc in their hearts and their minds because there's such a confusion of voices in their lives as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. I was studying, I was looking at Deuteronomy, which is kind of an odd thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, were you looking at that this morning while I was driving in?
I was. That was after the TED Talk listened to. But it's, I think of, you know, the Lord commanding to Joshua, be strong and courageous.
Yeah.
And I keep getting all these strong encouragements from God that we are to be bold and not be timid and to be courageous and strong. And these are great, powerful words and descriptors. And I think that pales in comparison to sitting in a corner looking at a screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know where you're getting empowered and strong and courageous and bold. Now, I don't know how to blend these two together because I'm not anti-technology because I recently got an iPad 2 and I got a great deal on it because it just had one scratch on it through the serial number. But it was something I look at a lot now. I use a lot.
Yeah, and I think there's a trick to utilizing technology and not becoming beholden or a slave to it. And mm-hmm. and I really can recognize those times in my life. And I appreciate that passage from Deuteronomy because if in any way I would indicate that with raising our kids and teaching students that I feel like I have this whole thing together, I don't. I feel very overwhelmed mm-hmm. Oftentimes by what's happening with the shift generationally into the technology and don't quite know how to process all of that yet and how to lead towards peacefulness and wholeness in the mm-hmm. midst of it.
And in Deuteronomy 31, verse 8, it says, the Lord himself goes before you and will be with you.
Yeah.
He will never leave you nor forsake you. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. So when you look at the news and you look over the headlines and you hear the stories, is there a tendency to be afraid and discouraged?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's I notice my agitation level raises substantially the longer that I'm on the internet or listening to the news. And again, what you just described, if I don't just shut it down for a little mm-hmm. while, I won't have those kinds of words whisper across my soul about be strong and courageous or know that the Lord is with
right.
you or to walk it out. And when that happens, then I can head back into the technology and into the news in an entirely different kind of way. But without that voice of the shepherd, I can't walk mm-hmm. those things out terribly effectively.
How often do you visit the cross when you go, when you think of the cross of Christ with yeah. Jesus hanging there, bloodied, beaten, and dying?
Yeah.
How often do you go there?
Yeah, not enough.
Okay, well, I'm just saying, I think that's such a powerful image.
It is, and I think it's a recognition that to try to squeeze all kinds of peacefulness and wholeness out of the things of this world, mm-hmm. maybe we're missing it. Jesus he gave up his whole life in recognition that there were some things that were pretty screwed up.
Right.
And so just to assume that everything we listen to is all leading us towards good and wholeness, that cross very much exposes some of the ways in which we've really screwed up.
Right. So as we're trying to get solitude and silence, what is it like trying to nurture your children to not want to like do things like spend a lot of time at the mall?
Yeah, I mean, that's tricky, isn't it? And it's funny these days because I almost sometimes want them to go to the mall just to hang out with their actual friends and not their virtual friends, but to not take their phones with them. I'm amazed at how often they're walking around the mall and not looking at each other and looking down at their phones as part of it. So I'm for the mall experience, sans the phone experience as part of it. Yeah,
okay, so that's part of community.
I think that shared experience can really matter if you're actually sharing the experience and not isolating yourself.
So it's more of a meeting place. It's not a place where I'm going to go and be fueled by my desire for more stuff.
Yeah, I don't see as much of that more stuff happening in the next generation.
Okay.
And that's some of the reading that I've seen is it's even part of why economically we struggle to get out of where we are as a country right now is there's this recognition the next generation doesn't want to buy everything like
I
did.
That's true.
And so, but there's an entirely different set of challenges that is a little bit more subtle and I think more difficult.
Yeah, it goes back to the point where they don't even want to get their driver's license when they turn 15.
It's amazing. I mean, I counted down the days.
First appointment on my birthday.
Absolutely.
I didn't even care that it was pouring rain and I stood a good chance of failing because the back window was all steamed up from rain. I didn't care.
Absolutely.
I was going to get that license.
Oh, man, I was pumped when I bombed, even when I bombed my parallel parking and rammed into the cone. It was just like, I'm in the game right now. It was fabulous. So.
Peter, always fun to have you in studio. Thanks for coming by. It is 27 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Good morning. It's 32 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a little pause for some more news. And then Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley. I'm going to work on making that into a rap song. I'm very excited about that. She'll be with us in about 8 minutes. Minutes until the top of the hour. Scott Sauls is a pastor and author. Wrote a book called The Power of True Friendship. He said, receiving correction may seem nearly impossible for you. And I find that interesting. I think great Dick Cabot line was, it's a rare man who wants to hear what he doesn't want to hear. Anyway, Scott Sauls says it has its place, and he offers a few examples.
One of the worst days of the year for a lot of people is when their boss reviews their year. Like, here's how you did. Here's where you can, you know, really celebrate, and here's where you can grow and improve. Everybody's terrified of that here's where you can grow and improve aspect, and I think we're like that with our character as well. Like, when my wife says, Scott, you're forgetting to do some things that are really important to me that you do around the house, and that hurts. Or you showed up late to our daughter's volleyball game, and you probably should circle back with her and apologize for that. Like, if I find myself getting defensive, which sometimes I do, I'm really missing an opportunity, right? An opportunity to believe the gospel that yeah, I messed up, but you know what? Grace is real, and that's what grace is for. It's there to cover us. There's no condemnation for us in Christ.
I really like Scott Sauls. He's a interesting thinker and communicator, and I've heard many, many of his sermons. So if you ever want to check out those, just Google Scott Sauls. And if you want to hear the rest of that interview, you can find that at myfaithradio.com. And Scott Sauls, S-A-U-L-S, The Power of True Friendship. We'll take a short break, and then Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley on the studio line already. Be back in a minute.
Do you believe your family should go to church every Sunday? Do you believe that you need to sit together in the service? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Questions every parent needs to answer. The responses will reveal your level of commitment to lead your family in their journey towards God. How about this? Are you going to make your kids attend youth group or go on mission trips? Would you allow your kids to attend a different church if that's where their friends are? Will you pray together as a family? As I stir the pot on these issues, I hope you'll take considerable time to think intentionally about the spiritual character of your family and how you and your spouse can foster a strong and growing relationship with God.
Having trouble parenting your teen in today's rapidly changing culture? Mark Gregston can help. Get instant access to Mark's free parenting course online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
Good morning. 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here. I also have said to Peter Kaffner, stick around. You got nowhere to go. And in fact, he didn't have anywhere to go, so he's sticking around, which I kind of like. Nice to have company here in the studio. I have Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley on the studio line. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Oh, I'm happy. I'm happy that I'm talking to you. And say hi to Peter Kapsner, Dr. Peter Kapsner.
Morning, Ann.
Hello, Peter. Good morning. How are you?
He loves your name and wants to buy its domain.
Oh, I wish I had Rathbone somewhere in my name. It's a great name.
I have to say it's pretty good. I mean, not
really
that I had
cool.
anything to do with it, but I like it.
Yeah, yeah. All right. I want to talk all kinds of things. I want to talk about a blog you wrote on unintended consequences. How do we limit the negative ones? Talk about that. Fascinating.
Sure. So in economics, this is kind of one of the first things you start to think about. The economists don't look at just the short run. We have to look at the long run as well. So we can take actions today, and those actions have short-term effects, and they have long-term effects. And the long-term effects could be good or bad. And so in economics, we call them unintended consequences because we maybe couldn't foresee them. And, you know, they're actually bad. So, you know, the question I was asking there was, how do you limit the negative or the bad unintended consequences? And I think part of the way we do that is we actually have to have a long-term view. We have to look, especially when we're thinking about, you know, policies, but this happens in our own private lives as well. So, you know, if you do something today, you know, let's say you go to, we're about to have Thanksgiving, right? And you eat a lot on Thanksgiving mm-hmm. and you have extra pie and you stay up till midnight and you have some more pie.
Mm-hmm.
It feels good in the moment, but the unintended consequence might be that you don't feel so good tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to really have a long-term view so that we can weigh the potential effects of what we agitate for and our choices.
Okay. I'm going to need you to continue elaborating on that because, What's all involved in this from the long-term negative consequences? I'm just trying to wrap my arms around how it applies to the goods and services that I buy.
Sure. So let me give a kind of an explicit example, and I'll try to wrap in your question, which is how does this kind of affect goods and services?
Yes.
So we may want to vote for a policy or vote for politicians who we think are going to support policies that might say, you know, the poor can't afford as much as we want them to be able to afford in terms of consumption goods, housing, clothing, food, medical care, things like this. So we might say, okay, well, the way that we can fix this in a policy arena is to limit the prices, to say, okay, you know, a doctor's visit can't cost more than $100 ever, regardless of whether it's open heart surgery or a flu shot. It can never go past $100. Now, this is a kind of thing that sounds very good on paper, right? Because it sounds like, okay, the politicians can come in, they can engineer the prices such that they say we're going to help the poor and the middle classes by saying you just can't exceed this price limit. So it's in the short term, we can, you know, the policymakers and the voters can go to sleep at night and say, look at what we did. Mm-hmm. We helped the poor. But what's the long-term effect of that? Well, it actually requires a doctor a lot of training, a lot of experience to perform open-heart surgery. So if we limit the amount that doctor can charge to be $100, and that doesn't cover his costs for being able to do that and his training and the hospital stay and the technicians that he requires to assist him, then what you're going to see is that that's no longer going to be available, at least in the open market. What mm-hmm. we tend to see is that there's kind of a black market or underground market where people will do this, you know, kind of informally in the economy. And you really don't want that with open heart surgery, right? You want
no.
everything to be above board and transparent.
Exactly.
So that's kind of an example of how we can say it might be nice for policymakers to just limit the prices people can charge, and that's going to help. But it really doesn't help. And that only comes to our understanding if we really understand how prices work.
Mm-hmm. And Neil Staben, who's the program director, often sends me harassing emails, things like quit parking in my parking spot, quit eating my sandwiches out of the staff refrigerator, blah, blah, blah. To me, it's noisy, glingy. I can't even deal with these. But he did send one, which was of kind of interest. And he said he heard a conversation on Michael Medved last week about an article that Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and talking about so much money concentrating in so few hands while so many mm-hmm. people struggle is not just bad mm-hmm. economics. It's a moral crisis, said Josh Hoxie, the report's author. And the question that Neil was posing was, is this really the greatest moral crisis of our day? And is closing the income gap the best solution?
Yeah, what a great question, and so timely right now. This is what everybody is talking about. And really, people have been talking about this, I think, as long as humans have been around. But
okay, Ann, can I put you on hold for a second? Because I'm getting a big wave that we have to go to break, and then I'm getting a wave from Neil that I might be losing my job. So let me take a break and be back in just a minute. Good morning. 13 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm in studio with Dr. Peter Kapsner, sticking around, which I appreciate. We're talking to Dr. Ann Bradley. And Ann, right before break, I asked you this big loaded question. What is the greatest moral crisis of our day? Is it closing the income gap? Is that the solution? You know, you think about all the jobs that Gates and Bezos and everyone else is responsible for generating. And so they're helping create wealth for others.
Absolutely. So do I think it's the greatest moral crisis of our time? No. Is the short answer. And the more kind of detailed answer is, you know, there's certain ways and certain in every society this is different. But the question you're asking really is, how are the wealthy getting rich? So the Bill Gateses of the world, I find it kind of ironic that Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, who are huge entrepreneurs, huge examples of entrepreneurs who have made a lot of money, they've made a lot of money because they have provided really important services that make all of us rich. And so in their entrepreneurship, they are making us better off. And so to kind of ask the question that when it comes from those guys, well, maybe this is a moral crisis that I'm really rich and others aren't, I think misses the entire system that they benefit from. I think it misses the point. Now, if we're going to look at a place like Afghanistan, this is a very different Democratic Republic of the Congo. To be kind of quote unquote rich or the elite in those societies, you're not a Jeff Bezos. You're not figuring out how to help your neighbors and provide goods and services to people. You're stealing from them. So I think it's a moral crisis when income is what we call in economics a zero-sum game. In other words, I only get something when I steal or take from you. But that's not how a market-based society such as the one we live in generally works. I mean, you know, yes, there are Bernie Madoffs. There's always examples of people who try to corrupt the system. But in general, in the United States, Norwegian countries. I mean, people are rich because they are entrepreneurs. And that's a really important distinction. I don't think that in the United States we could classify that as a moral crisis. Now, being rich doesn't solve all of our problems, of course, right? So we think it's going to in many cases. And I think this is when we deviate from the gospel and the teachings of Christ. So it's not just being rich is everything, but certainly being rich because people have brought entrepreneurial goods and services to us, that's not a bad thing. I would just say it's not the only thing.
You know, and you talk about a market-based society like that, and I'm seeing this pendulum swing economically where some of the people that you mentioned benefited so deeply from the entrepreneurial system are now coming and advocating for things like basic universal income, or I saw a stat recently where for the millennial generation, I believe 55% of them are more comfortable in a socialistic society than they would be with a capitalistic society. So what do you see relative to future and the next generation and expectations related to just how they're provided for economically, as you know, as opposed to being an entrepreneur, that something will be provided for them?
Yeah, this is such a good question, and I think we're moving kind of in the wrong direction. I would classify that there's a kind of whole host of things that I would classify as things that sound good on paper. The price controls we talked about at the beginning of today is one of them. I think kind of this idea that you can have democratized socialism is another thing that it sounds good on paper, right? It sounds good to say we're going to give everybody a basic universal income, which is not very different from the minimum wage conversation, right? I mean, we do these things and we try these things and they don't historically work. And so if we're going to be intellectually honest, I think we have to talk to the upcoming generation about this. Here's another thing, you know, you can't change it, but I do see it as a problem, which is that our generation, my generation at least, and my parents' generation, they went, my parents, for example, went through a world war. I mean, they experienced that and saw the devastation. You know, I saw the Cold War and the devastation of socialism and central planning. I mean, we just celebrated, I don't know if that's the right word, remembered the 100-year anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. 100 million people died in 100 years. because we ran the economy based on false assumptions. So see, everything hangs in the balance. And I think this is what, you know, the millennial generation, they didn't live through that. So they don't see the horrors of it. But look at Venezuela today.
Mm.
So there's still evidence of it. And I think we need to point, I try to do this with my students. We can't just pretend the world looks like, you know, is something that it's not. We have to look at the world and say, there are still people suffering today in places like Venezuela. Why? Why is this happening? Why are we so wealthy in the U.S. and Venezuela, which is an oil-rich country, experienced prosperity in the past, is so poor today? And well, I think there's a real solution out of these things. And I think we need to empower this generation with hope. It's not hopeless. But that we have to have our facts straight, and we have to understand what works and what doesn't work. So the kind of the things that sound good on paper, like central planning, they don't work.
Hmm. Well, I'm the only one on this interview that doesn't have students, so I'll ask the next question. Let's talk, Ann, a little bit about the value of gratitude and how it doesn't matter what job you're going to today and how you can operate with a grateful heart and how that can impact your work.
You know, we talk about this a lot at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics because, you know, over the last 150 years, I would say, kind of Christian theology, I think, has gone off the rails a little bit in terms of work. And we've kind of secularized work. And we say, well, work is secular and going to church is sacred. And, you know, whether I'm going to do a missions trip, that's sacred. And I think that's not true if you read scripture. At all. I think, you know, work is something, it's a gift. We all have skills and talents and abilities. And what we need is to be able to unleash them. I mean, this is the exact reason to our former conversation why people are poor. They're poor when they cannot do that, when they can't act in an entrepreneurial way with their gifts and talents. So I think, you know, we need to kind of reclaim the dignity and the value of work and empower people. And then I think there's gratitude and fulfillment that comes from that because you're doing exactly what God designed you to do. So for in my case, you know, professionally, I'm an economist. I'm not a professional tennis player, although that might be nice. You know, I might have wanted to do that, but I'm just not built for it. It's not my talent. And so I could try to run against the grain, to run against how God created me to do that because I said, well, this is going to bring me the most fame, the most money or whatever. But I'm going to be permanently frustrated because I'm running against God's design for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first thing for gratitude is that we have to say, who am I made to be? And then I need to live into that. And then I think we do feel appreciative of the freedom and the ability and the fulfillment that work brings. And we have gratitude that comes with that.
And what about the person that starts by saying, I'm just a, and then fill in the blank, whatever their job or occupation is?
Yeah, I don't think there's any justa. I think that's where we, again, let the culture tell us what to do. And myself, I'm including myself in this. You know, it's the culture would say, well, you have to be a lawyer or a doctor or famous. You know, the letters behind your name on your business card matter and all this kind of stuff. And I think, again, that kind of runs contrary to what we see in scripture, which is we all matter. All of our work matters.
Mm-hmm.
And think about the example that I used before, the surgeon who's going to perform open heart surgery on me someday, probably, right? And we're all going to need something like this in the future. That person can't do it alone. And we give all the glory to the doctors and the neurosurgeons and the, you know, heart surgeons and things like this. But they need a whole, they have to come together with a whole group of people, including janitors and the Federal Express truck driver that brings the supplies to the hospital and the nurses and the technicians and the people who make the machines on the factory floor.
Mm-hmm.
All of those people are required for this life-saving thing to happen. We only see the doctor. We don't see all the people behind the scenes.
Right.
And so I think when we have this bigger view of how we fit into the tapestry of work, then there's no, I'm just a, you know, janitor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I just work at McDonald's over the summer as a student.
Right.
If God's calling us to do it, it matters.
Right. I'm just working as a radio host until I can get a job as a waiter.
Exactly.
Right.
And then you can really fulfill your full calling.
That's right.
We shouldn't knock waiting tables, by the way.
Oh.
I did this for a long time to put myself through practice.
I know. Waiting tables is the best. You know, anyone who's in any performing sort of business, they always have to supplement their income with something like that. So I say that very affectionately. I love waiters. I eat out enough, believe me. I love waiters. Thanks, Ann, so much. Have a great day.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Take care. You bet. Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute of Faith, Works, and Economics. We'll take a short break and wrap up the show. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks to Dr. Peter Kapsner, who's still behind a microphone with me today. Say, Peter.
I can't leave, Billy. The coffee was great this morning.
It was good. That's all you're getting today, too, is a little coffee. But thanks for listening today, and thanks to all my guests, Dr. Ann Bradley. Really, what a great show we've had today. And tomorrow is no exception. We'll be back again in the morning at 6 a.m. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.